This poem was inspired by a time that I spent in northern India in a place called Galantaya, where the Dalai Lama had his summer home. And so it was filled with Tibetans, thousands of Tibetans, and gosh, monks as had come over the border from Tibet into India. It's called, oh, I got it published as well, so. Incense, Prayer Book, and Your Broken Tibetan Heart. I met you in Dharamsala. You carried your incense, prayer book, and your broken Tibetan heart. A nomadic beauty, glacier blue eyes, scarlet lips, flavoured with Darjeeling tea and pomegranates. We lit a candle. Oh, how I saw flames dance in your sad red eyes, burning for sacrificial hearts. Oh, how I saw your burgundy robe scatter the temple ashes with your hair. Oh, how I smelled incense burning in goblets of gold, fragrance drifting to cleanse the breeze. I heard the sitars strumming to the night jars as footsteps trudge on the hot dusty road from China. Your prayer beads worn as the last mantra resounds along 21st century wires. I met you in Dharamsala. You carried your incense, prayer book, and your broken Tibetan heart. And how I love the taste of Darjeeling tea and pomegranates on your forbidden scarlet lips.
Thank you, Linda. And next we have Charles Clark.
Great. Well. Hello.
Hello.
That's all pretty brief Clark and allegory. The only Clark poem this evening. It is an allegory. And the allegory depends on something to be found out at Riverstone House, if anyone has ever been there. If you go to the dining room of the house built in the 17th century by Jemmett Brown, Bishop of Cork, you will find in the dining room a stucco version of a painting by Poussin. Tying the Finn's truth was the assaults of discord and envy. The assaults of discord and envy, the tannoy and the pneumatic grill bruise my ears, the crumbling river wall wears a scarf of sow thistles, time's allies, the old mill, the pea green channel, were our reality amid brewers, topers, and the passing train.
Thank you, Charles. And next we have Rob O'Carr.
Greenback. This garden, this grass, that tree, those bushes, all memory contained, inurned, buried beneath the sward, unfindable by spade or pick, a bag of sticks in leaning lean-to by rusty axe with silver crescent blade, newly wetted for soon come season, while you rest unbroken and brilliant, strong and fit for the chopping.
Thank you, Rob. And to follow Rob is Colm's Cousin.
Last week someone said that, someone came up and said that there should be more poems about robots. I definitely agree with that. I wrote this journal, we put it's actually on a point, but it is about robots, so. It's called My Life as a Machine. When Henry hit the curb, he knew it was over. The sun got in his eyes. He had bent his left wishbone badly and knew he could not walk straight. He called the recovery service and they lifted him into the van, chatting with the man amicably as they drove to the depot. He sat there in the armchair surrounded by old robots, all de-energized. He overheard the talk about no parts available and not much point. He saw the look in his owner's eyes as he chatted to the engineer. We'll be back tomorrow, Henry. We'll see you then. He avoided her gaze. Within 24 hours, the information would start draining from his memory banks. He began to think back over his long life, his being switched on, the journey from the factory. He was a prototype, first in a long line of models built to last, before they cheapened the materials. That was back when robots were king, could do no wrong. He worked hard for all his owners, helping them with human life's practicalities, childcare, car maintenance, adult education. He sniffled slightly. He now wished he'd been more careful. Worn those sunglasses Margaret had given him. She'd been good to him since the anti-revolution, the advent of sameness. Took care of him well while others were thrown into scrap heap. He moved in his chair to ease the pain, reaching down and rubbing the human-like skin across his leg. His ankle was skewed 90 degrees outwards. He looked around him. He was just an old machine, gone out of production since the technology cap. No one cared for his kind anymore. People lived as people now, happy with what they had. And Margaret had no money to repair him. Even if she could scrimp it together, he knew there was no way back. He thought of all the changes he'd known in his life. Omniscience, suicide rights, trips to Mars, zero warfare, the cybernetic bulge, and then the changes stopping changed. It was strange, he thought, as someone dimmed the lights, how the smallest event can alter everything. Like when parents were arrested for stealing sweets from their children's party bags. It made all the humans stop and think, where were they going? Like hitting a curb at 4 miles an hour that you always knew was there, your eyes blinded by the sun. Oh, yeah.
And next we have Annette Skate. Is she? She's gone home. Okay, Edward Dwyer.
In this poem, a glamorous American woman steps off a train at a busy station in a busy city in Europe. Everybody around her is speaking a language she doesn't understand, but it is a rabble that sets a scene, like in a movie. She is, like in a movie, unconcerned with it. In the same poem, albeit a later draft, she blows a kiss at an unidentified cheek. This was a moment that changed the poem entirely at this early point, the strange moments that originally befalling the woman all deleted. That blown kiss was too important to leave hastily, as that version did. You'd have to think, if you wanted it, it was yours to snatch out of the air. Presumably, though, you'd have to act quick, as surely there would be others thinking the same. A recycled reference, in this poem, there is a wind. Not too much to be intrusive, just enough. A cabaret wind that makes her red dress dance on her body. but back to the kiss, still there to be grasped. It will change your day for the better, surely. You needn't even wear it on your cheek. What is to stop you wearing it on your lips, if that is, you catch it? This poem offers no less than a life-changing moment. Death would be a lesser foe, you'd have to think, with that kiss on your lips. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. That's lovely. And next we have Richard Altry.
This is called Hatchment. The word itself will drop one day, fade out, losing its diamond edge, retreating like the gauntlet that once lay beside this hatchment on the window ledge. These ancient soundings wither like the sedge around the lake, or better, mountain tongue of language, gently dripping down as tallow in a cricket, wearing thinner than those disused hassocks, swept out of sight into the thicket of some meagre lean-to aisle. Will our descendants simply grow laconic facing this subtle obsolescence? Our words resounding like old church Slavonic, shut off behind an icon of stasis. Of course, there is still pleasure in eclipse, expressed by larking through the cycle clips unfastened in an empty nave. And yet, beyond lies wordlessness and loss of one who lifts a mildewed rug to glimpse a mitered brass, or stares for hours into a whitewashed wall to heal a wounded cross. Oh, yeah.
Gerald Heffernan
is next. Hi. This poem is called Daymare. The human virtue of weakness is not a concrete amalgamation of faith and doubt. Rather, they bleed out to conquer as a void through interaction, or possibly to secrete the black void. Black concrete which sits on top of the void. This is an overcoming of banal opposition, trivial opposition which is to itself hidden. Disguised in the over there is the near, which spurts and spits out the rock of indifference, a suspicious rock which is unsure of that familiar rock. Our fate we consistently perceive through its opposition to doubt. The fires of doubt itself melt this fate rock and disperse this molten rock down the mountainside, transforming it into new matter. Matter familiar but uncanny, denied but remaining our footstool. Our proximity to our ideal rock and the ideal point of view is displaced or put under suspicion. This suspicion is usually ignored, denied, deferred, placated. The fire and water of our doubt and faith produce this congealed indifference upon which we precariously balance. This indifference shouts to us, I am the railing alongside the torrent. Those who grab me may hold on, but I am not your crutch. This place of indifference and suspicion of both the railing and the torrent is the space where we deny ourselves residence. It is the other space, the place that makes us long for longing, an act of instinctive weakness brought on by the rituals of faith and the suspicion of doubt. Only by this violence can we progress, only by violence of indifference. Our human weakness is not to succumb to indifference and its violence, or not even to long for such things, but rather our inhumanity is to be indifferent to this indifference, preferring instead in our inhumanity proper judgment and inerrant action. The foolish man sounds wise when he is silent, but the wise man sounds foolish when he is a fool.
Next we have one of our two winners of the Munster Slam Poetry Championship, Fergus Costello.
This one is called "To Share Your Hoo-Ha Can Be Very Good for the Soul." Hope you like it. I have been blessed to do my hoo-ha at three national finals, Dublin, Derry, Cork. Once I came third, I even came second twice. What the meaning is all this, Fergus, I hear myself say. Am I to be remembered as the quintessential, almost nearly, but not really, maestro of the spoken word? The biggest loser on the modern era of Irish performance poetry. Some say I'm not half bad, others mumble he makes a fine bridesmaid, but he'll never nail a genuine honeymoon shag. Is there to be no tiara for me? I'm considering retirement from this slam band, thank you, man. 3 minute competition time limit. It wrecks my head. Posing in front of a microphone, my last few remaining brain cells petrified by paranoia with the horrific image in my mind's eye of some civil service-minded, trigger-happy stopwatch Nazi armed with a buzzer, bell, or maybe even a soothing Buddhist gong. Oh, I'm the itching to show me over the edge of the bursting or heaven forbid me, far from calming Buddhist bong, precipitating the horrendous sight of a grown adult cacking his pants in public in front of a room full of strangers. Time on this planet is way too precious for that sort of crap. Believe me, I have enough shite in my life without that, so exit from the 182nd discipline beckons me. I'm more of an Arlo Guthrie man myself when he sang about ants and a restaurant. What, I ask, is so wrong about a 20-minute song? As long as you are making time. Stand nicely still, holding the whole room lovingly in the cradle of your hand. The Holy Ghost only horsing through you like sheer gar, creating a little bit of magic. For no other reason than to share your hoo-ha can be very good for the soul. Whether just 3 minutes or 20. Then again, maybe I won't hang up my 3 minute sprinting shoes. Perhaps I will give that first prize cheap bottle of champagne one last shot. After all, seriously, apart from my dignity and a clean pair of underwear, what have I possibly got to lose?
The gong every time the Kobe fans have jumped. I take great offense
with
that. I'll get you for that one. Thank you. Next, we have the man in the very visible jacket, Seamus Harrington.
Alright. Thanks, Sue. We're at a very good lecture earlier on the Russian space program above an UCC, and Sputnik 1 was mentioned. I was lucky enough to have seen it for a few seconds a long time ago, and I dug this out then because it reminded me of a time a couple of years ago when a neighbour called, "Come out fast, come out fast. The International Space Station would be passing overhead." So out we went and kept watching and kept watching and kept watching. And there's a mention here of space tourism. Sir Bob Geldof, I think, is in line for that. So International Space Station. The only distant specks to spot up there, occulting stars that were light years away. An absent moon sent word by flicker ray, "Don't get too near to my ionosphere." Of course, she's not about to make a rare appearance, cause it's past her ETA. When waypoints wink inside the Milky Way, will space unearth another billionaire? research and pride of 16 states gone west. Perhaps we'd have to chart a new black hole, commemorate the astronauts deceased. But wait, haha, of course, I should have guessed. Our compass is inclined towards hyperbole. They're over here and nowhere near the west. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. We'll go all be gazing at the stars now after this. And next we have Cathal O'Donovan.
This is a poem about the only wedding I've ever attended. The bride and groom were both 83 years old. This works better as a story than as a poem. The poem tells the story, but not all the details, just to get the full picture. My great aunt Rita Tenhead, when she was about 30, she went to a working holiday in Canada. And not long before she left, one of her friends, a man named Harry Conlon, gave her a ring and said, "This will come back to me." And Rita said to Harry, "Harry, if I wasn't coming back, it would be going." But while she was in Canada for a working holiday on the summer, she met a man named Alec Point and fell in love with him, and had to send a letter back home to Harry saying, "Harry, I've met someone else. I'm going to marry him. I can't come home and marry you. I'm very sorry about this." And Harry's heartbroken, but life goes on. Now, cut ahead 50 years. They've both gotten married to other people at this stage. Now, her marriage to Alec Point has kind of gone a bit sour towards last stretch, but eventually Alec dies anyway, so it doesn't matter. not long after Alec died, she got a letter in the post from Harry Conlon saying, "I'm a widower too, and I'm still waiting for you." And she still had the ring that he gave her 50 years beforehand. And so the two of them, aged 83, both dying of illnesses at this stage, fast-tracked a wedding, and everyone on both sides of Andy was like, "What the fuck?" And everyone from Canada, all five of her kids and all their kids all crammed into Antrim, and everyone, I think Harry had moved to England at this stage, and his whole family from England crammed into Antrim, and my grandmother was the link to Cork, so her grandmother's entire family has to all crammed into Antrim as well. All of us watched two 83-year-olds getting married, and 2 months later, Harry Conlon was dead. And 2 months after that, my great aunt Rita Cannon Point Condon was also dead. So this is my poem I wrote about that. Everyone knows that story.
Have a song. Be good.
I wrote this as a song, so this is a very jovial mood. But it is actually a jovial song at one point outside. This is one of the only songs I've ever actually written, so don't hate me too much. Anyway. See snowflakes falling down the aisle. This summer's winter love won't die. See love that's waited all this time. 10,000 years, 10,000 days, 10,000 miles. See here she's coming dressed in white. How far she's come to be a bride. Her sons and daughters watch a sigh. Can't let this life-lost love pass by. That summer heard a thousand smiles. That's up to snowflakes reunite. And see him take her hand at last, and hold till winter's summer pass. He waited 50 years for love. I pray those 2 months were enough. 1 year to lovers she survived. Now see her standing by his side. See snowflakes falling from their eyes. They know that true love never dies.
Oh,
Master of the Cold Feast, Cal Doyle.
Good job.
By a young woman by the name of Emily Berry. The poem was called The International Year of the Poem. It was a big year for poems. In the year known variously as the Year of the Frog, the International Year of Sanitation, the European Year of Intercultural Dialogue, the Year of Planet Earth, and starting on February the 7th, a Chinese Earth Rat Year. An exploding poem halfway across the visible universe became the farthest known object perceptible to the naked eye. In January, the price of poems hit $100 per poem for the first time. There were poems in space. Iran launched one. And India set a world record by sending 10 poems into orbit in a single go. No one could deny that poems were powerful. Ireland voted to reject poems. Glasgow proclaimed independence from them. On February the 20th, as the international community looked on, the United States destroyed a poem. Israel followed suit. We have now declared war on the poems of Gaza, said Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. I reiterate that we will treat the population with silk gloves, but we will apply an iron fist to poems. The threat of poems was constant. In Cairo, at least 8 poems dislodged from a cliff, burying 500 people. In Kyrgyzstan, a poem with a 6.6 magnitude killed 65. George Bush was almost struck by a poem. The global poem crisis had begun. In defense of poems, the UN General Assembly affirmed the potential contribution of the poem to defeating world hunger. Hence, the International Year of the Poem and its associated ventures, such as the World Poem Atlas, and the International Symposium on Living with Poems. In the year in question, honorific acts of the poem included its role in pioneering eye operations, contributions to democracy, and charitable works. Mark Humeon, Professor of Ophthalmology and Biomedical Engineering at the Dahmey Eye Institute in Los Angeles, California, said, "The poem is very, very small, so it can go inside your eye." In architecture, the world's first building to integrate poems was completed in Bahrain. A poem entered the White House, inspiring untold poems. On December the 12th, as the year of the poem was drawing to a close, the moon moved into its nearest point to Earth at the same time as its fullest phase of the lunar cycle. The moon appeared to be 14% bigger and 30% more poem than the year's other full moons. Poems were going off across the world. In Baghdad, Athens, the Gaza Strip, St. Petersburg, Dhaka, as the year tipped.